Welcome to Happy Path Programming. I'm Bruce Eckel.
I'm James Ward.
All right, welcome. Today we have with us Artie Starr. And Artie, I was introduced to you by Justin Riach from Gradle. We had him on a while back to talk about developer productivity stuff. And Justin was like, if you're talking about developer productivity, you have to talk to Artie because she's doing actual research and academic research into this. And since then, I've seen some of your talks around this, one at Spring One, I think recently. And so anyways, welcome, Artie. Great to have you on.
Right.
Thanks. And happy to be here.
I had a, let's see, I watched videos on YouTube that you did, and I think there was one, I think it was in 2019, pretty sure. And at that time, you were pitching a company. And then since then, you switched to doing a PhD. Is that right?
Oh, I'm still doing company stuff.
Oh, it's so. still a company. Okay, I see.
So yeah, this I'm an entrepreneur / PhD student.
Okay. Okay. And you decided to get a PhD after, I think you said you were a professional developer for 20 years or something, and then you decided to get a PhD, which is an interesting, I mean,
I was, what drove that?
Yeah. What there must have been some sort of aha moment where you go, wait, I don't want to just do this. I want to do that.
I don't think my ambitions have really fundamentally changed. It's just sort of like turned into a pathway to get there. So after I finished my book, which was over 10 years ago now, I went
what
on
was your
speaking.
Book?
Oh, so my book is called Idea Flow, How to Measure the Friction in Software Development. So I spent 5 years writing this book after a number of painful experiences in software development. And I was on this really great, this is kind of a total side venture question here, but I was on this really great team. We had, you know, CI, unit testing, continuous delivery, design reviews, code reviews, I mean, like all the things. And despite all that, I watched the project, you know, hit a wall, and we brought down production 3 times in a row, didn't ship again for another year. And I mean, we basically, like, despite us going through the motions of all the best practice things,
you were doing everything you were supposed to be doing, and yet something was not working.
But the complexity of the system eventually kind of outstripped us, and it was a statistical process control system, so a very like data driven sort of thing. And so one of the things I learned in that context is you know, the importance of having data-driven sort of testing stuff, because you've got this, you know, combinatorial sort of explosion of possibilities, and just functional coverage is just insufficient to test and make sure your application is actually, you know, working.
As a whole, yeah.
As a whole. I mean, it just, so you know, I learned a lot in some of those contexts. And then I had another project, you know, that I was on that was, you know, really great, had like this amazing team I was working on, and things were going awesome. You know, it was just like Ferrari awesome project. And then, you know, we got new management that came in and just sort of watched the whole thing get crushed by bad decisions.
Huh.
And in that frustration of the communication problems, in that disconnect, as well as like things I'd learned on the first project to identify like where our problems were, and you know, come up with strategies to pragmatically, empirically try and figure out where our pain was so that we could solve those problems, I sort of rage wrote my book in just frustration of just because the thing is with software, it's like we pour our hearts into these projects, right, that we're building on. We have this connection to our work and our creation as well as our team. And it's really hard watching bad decisions cause your project to crash and burn. And it sucks. It's painful. It's heartbreaking. And at some point, you know, you let these things go and move on to the next project and stuff. But these patterns just seem to be like these, you know, ongoing, you know, classic stories in software development that we experience over and over again because of just, you know, these you know, some of these fundamental communication disconnects between like management world and engineering world and these control dynamics and the lack of visibility of what's going on. I was just so frustrated with that.
Are you familiar with Gerald Weinberg's work?
On what specifically?
Well, he's written tons of books, but he's most famous for saying, no matter what they tell you, it's always a people problem. which ultimately, you know, and it's like, I think it sounds to me like you came to that realization and you stepped back and you said, okay, maybe Agile and Scrum and stuff.
They're not fixing the people problem.
Well, because they were only peripherally trying to fix the people problem. And so you said, well, let's step further back and really look at what are the issues. And it also sounded like you were wanting to look at different inputs than just, I don't know, keystrokes per minute or whatever. You were going, how do you feel while you're writing your code and when you get frustrated? And let's look at that and see those as friction points. Is that?
Yeah. So looking at what is the developer's experience as they work in the code, and then how do we come up with an empirical way to measure and even, you know, model and how to conceptually think about when we're getting into flow and what is friction, you know, how do we even like conceptualize what's going on? Like you get into this space of cognitive processes while doing development, and flow is something that it's like, on one hand, we like know this is important, but you know, I was listening to some talks at a recent Flow State conference that Stack Overflow put on. And one of the things that became quickly apparent is that we lack this vocabulary to even be able to conceptualize and talk about what's going on in those cognitive processes. So my research effort has largely focused on being able to break down and coming up with a kind of ontological model of developer flow and these different processes and things we go to, and come up with an empirical way that we can measure friction and flow. So that was sort of like what my book was about, is that beginning of that paradigm shift around focusing on our developer experience in those cognitive processes we were going through. And then basically, like, when we're experiencing friction, what is the code we're working on when those experiences happen? And then looking at those correlations as a way to identify where our problems are, as opposed to just sort of our typical ways of, hey, this code over here looks complex. Let's fix that.
And I should point out, I think you said your book is on LeanPub, right?
Yeah, it's on LeanPub. Okay. It's on LeanPub.
All right. Good, good.
Nice. And it's called Idea Flow. Yeah.
Idea Flow. So one of the things that you observed, I think, about Agile and Scrum was that we were trying to make better communication with the stakeholders, but we tend to focus on technical debt. And you kind of analyzed that and said, oh, from your studying, and you've done some studying in business as well, and you said, okay, the business people, they understand debt as a controllable thing. You know, it's like, it's actually not bad for them. And we say, oh, technical debt, it's terrible. And so we needed to change our perspective in how we communicate, because risk is something that does bother the business people. And
yeah.
So how do we express what's going on in terms of risk rather than technical debt? Did you come up with a way to do that?
Yeah. So on that topic, so before I quit my day job to be an entrepreneur and go down that road, I was a CTO at a technical recruiting and consulting company. And so during that kind of process of going from more individual contributor, team lead, to like getting more involved in management, I was fortunate to get, you know, sent to a bunch of kind of MBA training related things, but I'm hanging out with a bunch of business folks that don't really know anything about software. And so I was in one of these MBA classes, And I'm talking to these folks and I'm explaining this concept of technical debt, right? And I explain, the interest rate thing and how technical debt works and stuff. And they're like, oh, that doesn't sound so bad. I'm like, what? Why does that not sound bad? You should
right.
be like,
you're like, this is horrifying. Like, technical debt is the worst thing ever. And they're like, oh, we have debt. It's fine.
Debt is okay. Yeah. And then you must have said, oh my gosh, we have been solving the wrong problem.
Well, what I realized is how business people think about like money allocation and stuff is from this kind of top down perspective of like I've got this money. Say I've got $1 million and $10 million, whatever it is that I need to decide how I'm going to invest. And you've got various buckets you can put the money in. I can invest money in sales or marketing or my engineering team development stuff, whatever it is. I'm basically like making allocation decisions about how to divide up the money to put into these buckets, right? And so if I know that my engineering costs are going to have this predictable increase in costs over time, then that means
totally fine. Yeah.
That's totally fine. I just account for that and go, okay, well, I should probably just, put some more money into sales to compensate for this increase in costs that is very predictable, right? So we're communicating the problems that we're experiencing in terms of a loan, which is looked at as a like leverage tool, right? Uh-huh. When really the reality is we're talking about a complete loss of control, the wheels falling off the bus, our ability to make changes to the software and to deliver to the software going away and just going out the window and like, we can't work on it anymore. We're going to have to like rewrite the whole thing from scratch because nobody understands what's going on anymore. We've lost control, right? And so like we're communicating a very predictable, steady increase in costs over time is what we're communicating and telling management when we say, oh, this is a technical debt thing and it works like interest rates. We're like communicating in terms of that when that's not really what's going on at all. And so we're not properly scaring management like we should be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think that sums it up well. Yeah. So
framing it in terms of risk or something has a different interpretation from the business side than debt does.
Yeah, well, you're telling them something that they're totally comfortable with, and you're going, no, no, this is really serious, but it's debt. I know what debt is. It's fine.
Whereas risk is something that the organization and management is very averse to.
Oh, well, the whole hierarchical structure is to keep things the same. And if it's like you introduce risk, oh, no, we don't like that. We want to keep everything the same.
Yeah. The other part of that is that, like the reason we try and use all these sort of metaphors and stuff is starts with this assumption of the people that we're talking to just aren't going to understand our world. And so we're like, it's kind of like a credit card, right? I mean, like we're doing that because we like, they're not going to understand what we mean. So we got to come up with some way to try and communicate using some metaphor or something, right? But I think there's ways that we can communicate what's going on in much closer ways to things that they can really get a better idea without necessarily reaching for some like super abstract metaphor that isn't necessarily all that representative of what's going on. So like, for example, one of the things I talk about is this experience of confusion. So even if you've never been a software developer, you probably can experience or relate to the experience of being confused and stuck and not knowing what's going on or being able to figure something out and how frustrating it is
constantly
when you're stuck, right? And that happens a lot in software development. I mean, like we have to build up skills to be comfortable in that place of uncertainty and stuckness and be confident enough in our skills that eventually we'll figure it out. But like for people that don't have any experience with software, if we relate it to things that they're actually familiar with, and just like imagine your developers being confused and stuck and not knowing what's going on, not knowing what to change, not understanding how the system works to be able to change it because the software has become so confusing and complex that they can't work anymore. And what you need to do, the risk you're managing, is being able to sustain the team's understanding of the software. Because once you lose that active knowledge and your ability to like know what's going on in the system, and especially if you have high turnover and people like walk out the door and you lose that knowledge, it's really, really difficult to come into an unfamiliar code base and be able to figure out enough what's going on to be able to manage it. Not necessarily impossible, but it's once you get to that point, it's often faster and easier to rewrite than it is to try and recover that lost knowledge, right?
So, right. And I think there's another factor here, which is our culture in the computer world is admitting that you're confused or you don't know something is not acceptable. So we have to work a lot to get to the point where we can go, yeah, I'm confused. I don't understand that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting connection to being a consultant. It's like you're assumed to be the expert on all these things. And so we hire the expert consultants to come in and they will know everything. They will understand it all. They'll be able to enter that complexity and not be confused.
Yes. There was a Dilbert cartoon that said consultant is the combination of confuse and insult. That's what a consultant does.
Yeah. So what's been the kind of output or the like, what have you done to help businesses or developers connect to the business better around that? I think maybe there's some talks or what's have you like come up with a thesis of like, here's how we can do this better? Or you described like a,
well, so you're preparing to do an iteration and you're talking about, okay, here's what we're going to implement. How do you communicate the very, you know, you got the stakeholders saying, oh, well, yeah, here's what's most important to us. How do you communicate the risks? And, oh, and also, have you read Waltzing with Bears? That's about risk. Huh. Yeah. That's a really good perspective book. Yeah.
So yeah. So have you developed like the system to fix this or something?
Well, this gets back to the why I'm in grad school now, you know, okay. Question too. So I'd been working on this kind of paradigm shift of looking at how do we measure the friction in our experiences. And I wrote my book. I became a speaker on like No Fluff Just Stuff tour.
Oh, nice.
Traveled the country giving talks on all this stuff for a few years and kind of burned out a bit doing that. But trying to communicate these ideas in that kind of way, in a way that they can have any kind of real traction and impact and stuff, is hard to near impossible. Mm-hmm. And part of that too is like, well, I'll come back to this thread. there's this other thread of being a woman speaker and the impact of that and the difficulty of trying to get a message out is a whole nother thread of challenge of, and you know, reasons why I've been frustrated too. Like, you know, I was the only woman speaker on tour at the time. And, you know, I had all this original material and contribution and stuff. And yet the response I'd get is, oh, I'm so glad we have a woman on tour. It's so awesome that you're a woman. And I'm like, I'm so glad I could help with the demographics. Right. But it's frustrating because people just like assume that you don't have anything interesting to contribute. And so I like those kinds of frustrations and things and the difficulty of that. And
there is the token, not there for the ideas that right. are and changing to, the developer's world. And
you
making
have to go to
better.
That extra effort to prove yourself despite. Yeah. Yeah.
That's frustrating.
So part of the reason why I ended up like, cause I believe in what I'm doing and that this approach is something that really has, is something that, you know, is possible to just fundamentally be game changing. And yet I was struggling so much with with trying really hard to get ideas out there and stuff and struggling with it. And so at some point I'm like, well, what if, cause I was effectively gravitating toward researchy things already, you know, anyway, with the work I was doing, just like in the field and pragmatically trying to gather data to solve, you know, problems I was facing in the moment on a team. Right. But, you know, essentially I was already kind of doing research and developing theoretical models and stuff, but, you know, I didn't know how to do proper like research. Right. So, I wanted to have the opportunity to basically be able to formalize the work and things I was doing. And hopefully if I have a, you know, formal thesis and papers and doctorate level gravitas, that will help, with respect to getting ideas out there, but also, I'm also having a lot of fun. Like, I mean, having the opportunity to like go and I'm learning, how to do like grounded theory research and really put together like formalized theories around coming up with, you know, models of developer flow and friction and being able to do studies to, you know, really prove out the ideas. And my hope is that going down this road and putting that formality and stuff behind the research, I'll be able to get my ideas out there. But, you know, it's driven partially by that frustration, though, at the same time.
Yeah. Well, but your ideas are not mainstream. I mean, talking about friction and flow is not. And so you probably need that extra, okay, here's the research, I have a PhD, et cetera, to get people to go, oh, maybe we should think about this. Because right now it's like, oh, that's not how we're used to thinking about things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just a fringe weirdo that nobody has to listen to, right? You know.
But once you get the PhD and you got the research, then they'll have to listen.
Yeah. It's been interesting though, because I show people like what I'm working on and they're like, you've got like five PhDs here worth of stuff. Like I have so much original contribution and stuff. It's just trying to evangelize ideas and stuff out there is just it's a hard road. But you know, as I said, I believe in what I'm doing, so I keep on going. No matter how many times I fall on my face, I keep on going.
What would you say is your mission? You've kind of talked about like this like drive to like fix something. What are we trying to fix?
Mission at multiple levels, but like, and this is what I was talking about more at my keynote I did at Spring One, which was focused on flow and joy, is kind of taking a step back and thinking about what matters and thinking about what we want and what we ought to aim for. And I think my goal really is to reignite just the vitality of imagination that we, for us to like be able to believe that things could be better, to be able to believe that we have the capability to dream and build and create a better world for ourselves because we want to, and we have the capability to do it. We just don't because we're so constrained by the existing rules of the machine and playing the games that are fed to us, but we don't necessarily have to. So if you take a step back and go, okay, what is it we want? What actually matters?
Yeah.
And what I came to in the conclusion was like, joy matters. Thriving matters. And if we think about how do we orient around a model of thriving as sort of like a definition of as to whether we're making things better, what would that look like? What would systems look like that were organized that way? What would companies look like that were organized that way? What type of entrepreneurial things might we do? What, you know, it's like, so if you reimagine what kind of things would exist in that context, I think what I'm trying to do mission-wise is kind of unchain people from the existing constraints to be able to imagine a better world such that we can build a better world.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Thiel organizations?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
So your mission is to help developers thrive, and that's cool because like, who's thinking about that? Like, I think it's just you, because I certainly would love to thrive as a developer, but no one is out there doing research and trying to understand how to actually make that happen. So that's cool.
Well, that's not entirely true. Like for example, like Kat Hicks, and she's, you know, another person that's kind of a doctorate level researcher person out there, but she just recently did a talk and a bunch of research specifically around this paradigm shift from developer productivity to developer thriving. And with this frame of productivity, she made lots of really interesting and good points about, like, when we orient toward this world of like judging ourselves in terms of whether we're being productive or not, and what we feel bad about and what we feel good about, just, you know, around, you know, are we being as efficient as we could be, as the goal that we sort of aim for? Like, when we look at the world through that frame and we measure ourselves and think about things through that frame, there's all these sort of like weird dysfunctional kind of effects of just thinking about things that way as our goal. And, you know, and often we can end up doing things that end up undermining the the thing we're aiming for at the same time, right? Just because if efficiency is the most important thing, like, yeah. For example, what are we aiming for? Like, we can really efficiently create crap, right?
Yeah.
And is that meaningful, right? And so so she presented a initial kind of model of how to sort of like break down and think about and reframe things from a developer thriving perspective. And I think that's something that we really should run with and think about and imagine how we can orient around thriving as
right.
a
is
sort
productivity
of
really what we want?
Well, right. When you think about it, the framing is really important, because when you say developer productivity, it turns the person into a machine whose job is to crank things out. And when you talk about developer thriving, it changes the perspective to almost, well, again, I'll mention Gerald Weinberg. His first book was called The Psychology of Computer Programming. It's quite a while ago, but I mean, it's like, oh, well, let's look at this in terms of the person as a person and not as a machine whose goal is to crank out code and bring profits to the company. And also that if we do, and I think the big shift is to make it like to make the argument that, oh, if we do that, the company will do better. If you have happy programmers, your company will do better.
I guess that's a big part of the shift, is the assumption, at least in normal business, is that higher productivity is the most important thing from developers.
Mm-hmm. And whatever that costs for the developer, that's fine. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's the basic capitalist idea. It's like, well, we got a resource, we got to extract everything we can from it to maximize profits. But then when you start looking at, well, no, this is a system that needs to be tended, and if we do that, then we will do better.
Hmm. Well, there's probably an element of creativity in here. So I've been wanting to hear about your connection to art, because I think you're also an artist. And it seems like if you're just focused on productivity, maybe that's not the best environment to promote creative thinking and creative solutions and all that. Is there some connection to creativity there?
Yeah. Like if being able to innovate and come up with new ideas and come out of caring about our customers, having the space to be able to dream. And the thing is, I found about like being in that creative space though, too, is like, when we're in that survival mode, that gear, all of our brain power is like focused on detecting and mitigating threats. And until we can get out of that survival mode gear, you can't really be in that creative, innovative space. It's like you have to get past that mode such that you could reallocate all your brain power to innovation and dreaming and creation space. And so I think as long as we're like sort of looking at developers as machines and stamping out widgets for the factory and instead of shifting to a mode of like, hey, we're a bunch of humans hanging out together as a team, and we have the capability to build something amazing with all of our skills combined. What should we build? And, what would be like worth our while that would be meaningful to spend our time on? And then when you're doing something, it's okay if it's hard, right? Like it being difficult and worthwhile makes it a really cool, fun mountain to climb. And when you can climb that mountain with other people that are like cool, that you like hanging out with, that become your friends on the team, and you're doing this journey together to build this thing, not only does it like pull you in and you get hyper productive because you're super focused and excited about it and connected to this thing that you're building. So you get productivity as a side effect of doing something that you genuinely care about.
Ultimately, it seems like it's about motivation. And the way management has been trained is that, well, you motivate people by compelling them. And what you're saying is you motivate people by enticing them.
Yeah. Giving them.
I feel like, you know, if I think about like a lot of software work, it comes out of love. Like in that if I'm working on some coding thing, me trying to make it beautiful, trying to do a good job, comes out of caring about my team, the customers. Like we do it out of a sense of connection with something. And different developers operate differently. Some developers will get just excited for the beautiful craftsmanship of thing, and that's fine. Other developers, they do it for their team. Other developers, they get really excited about wanting to build something for the customers and having their software that they create be used and help someone in a useful way. So there's various different things that people connect to and are driven by, but there's always some aspect of that that keeps us going even when it's hard. And I think that's the thing with software, is that because it's so hard, it's like once you lose that spirit of connection, of care, it becomes near impossible to do the work when you don't care anymore. Like you see, like in organizations and stuff, when you see that disheartening effect happen, something happens and the developers like lose their heart in it, right? I mean, it's game over. Yeah. You know, it's like,
yeah, that's
it's
when like, productivity actually ends up plummeting.
I don't want to do this anymore. This is not fun anymore.
No. So productivity as a side effect to having an environment where developers thrive and care and are connected.
Right. And so we hold a conference up here every year in the wintertime, and it took me a while. Because I mean, people would be very emotional during the closing session, and I was going, "Wait, this is a technical conference. This isn't about that." And then finally, I realized, "No, it is about that, because it's about the connection, and that's really what the conference does." And I didn't realize it until basically people told me in various ways, and it's like, "Oh yeah, why get together if it isn't about connection?"
Yeah. So back to your framing on the management enticing, I don't think it's really enticing, because that's like having the right carrot to dangle. This is a function of like intrinsic.
Wrong motivation. Word, probably.
Well, I think invite would be a good word, like creating space.
Inspire.
And then inviting people into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's interesting is that we're talking about things kind of in the realm of motivations and inspiration and the art of programming and some of that, but you're doing like actual research that seems like it would be hard to like pair those two of like, how do we measure these things and how do we quantify how do you quantify an artist, you know, like in their
because
work.
There's a statement in the business world that you can't, I mean, I don't believe it, but they say, you can't manage what you can't measure. And there are some things that you can't measure, you know? And so what does that mean? You just, oh, well, we can't do anything about that. And I think what you're trying to do is at least bring some of those things that we previously decided couldn't be measured. And it's like, maybe you can't measure everything, but you can get indicators. You can, you know, you can say, all right, well, this is a good way to go. Maybe that's not a good way to go. Maybe so. And it seems like this is some of the stuff you're struggling with.
Yeah. So my thesis project is developing a theory of momentum in software development. And with that, as a measure, so I'm kind of developing an explicit model of how momentum is accomplished, and then shifting to thinking about that as something we try and optimize for, and that if you can't get into flow, if you manage to get into flow, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to write good code when you're in flow. But if you manage to get into flow, you're much more likely to be focused and do good work and things like that. So I think something that we can reasonably aim to get better at with empirical information that is a good leading indicator of health in terms of developer experience and all of the code and technology aspects and stuff that affect that. So momentum, let me just give you the
big
picture version of this. So if you think about this process of getting going with coding and getting your momentum going. So first thing we do is we kind of like look around at the code and try and figure out what we're going to do. Come up with some kind of strategy to, you know, accomplish it. So we're kind of like looking around, not really typing anything, but it's like an inflow of information, right? And then at some point, then there's a eureka moment where we have some kind of coding strategy pop in our head, and we have some idea of the steps we're going to take. And it's usually still, we have some kind of vision, an idea of strategy, but it'll be fuzzy sort of still, but enough that we can go, okay, I see the first few stairs on the pathway. Maybe the rest of the stairs are kind of foggy still. But as you start walking up the stairs, you know, it becomes clear as you go. And you get enough clarity that you can start going and moving and making the changes that you're planning for, right? So we have, you know, that inflow process, then the eureka moment. And then at that point, then you start getting the momentum going. And as you get into that deeper, your level of absorption with that task increases, and you get into this kind of feedback loop flow state where the you and the code sort of become one, if you will. And the especially if you're fluent in the language, you're not really thinking about coding syntax. You're just like communicating to the computer what it is you want it to do, right? And so we get into that flow state as our momentum builds up until you get to like a kind of peak absorption level where you're, and at that point you're kind of like at a maximum level of efficiency. So if you think of your momentum building over time as this kind of exponential effect that happens, and as we get deeper into flow, you get this effect of increasing efficiency in your thought work that you can do when you're deep in that flow state. And so if we think about momentum that way, as sort of having these exponential effects over time, it gives us a different perspective on things like the impact of interruptions. So now, if let's say during the day, you know, I'm working on coding things, and then I've got a couple meetings or something, and like there's a meeting at 10 o'clock, say. And so I get up, I might do a little bit of coding and stuff, but it becomes difficult to get into it, to get your momentum going, because I got this meeting at 10 o'clock coming up, right? And then so I go to the meeting, I come back. Okay, now I got this meeting in my head. I got to switch that context to here and try and get the momentum going again. But often, like in order to get over that hump with getting to that eureka moment coding strategy, we really got to be heads down focused to be able to internalize enough of the context model to have those insights. And if we don't have enough consecutive time to be able to get there because of all these interruptions and distractions, it's easy for like a couple meetings to result in you don't get anything done during that day, you know, because you just can't get going. So if we can take these sorts of things into account, so just as a simple example of this exponential effect of momentum, then we can realize, hey, 2 hours doesn't equal 2 hours, right? Mm-hmm. That if we take these things into account and focus on trying to better get into a flow state and optimizing for flow on our teams, it's a good leading indicator for our ability to be productive without trying to measure
keystrokes.
Yeah, keystrokes and things.
Well, it's interesting because people have looked at flow before, but it's always like, oh, flow is good. Yeah, we should have that. And what you're trying to do is say, no, flow is fundamental. That's what we should build around.
Yeah. I mean, I think I think we need to look at our coding experience as a flow experience and take that into account with how we think about how to make things better. And as well as like friction and how it gets in the way of that is thinking about friction relative to flow.
And friction. So my experience has been, I tend to focus on, oh, here's this big hurdle that's really important, but it's easy to narrow in on that thing. And then I have slowly discovered, oh, there's all these little things which in my head I go, oh, that's not a big deal. And it turns out that that's the thing that impedes me. Like when I started painting, I discovered that, oh, I have this stretched canvas and it's like, oh, that's too precious. I can't put, and so I had to, and it was just that little thing that kept me from doing stuff. I had to go to canvas boards because they're cheap, you know, and I go, oh, it's not important. And it's like that was in my head a hurdle. And I think, yeah. Wow, what are all of these hurdles that people, and I would say that's summed up as friction. It's not this big obvious thing that you have to struggle with, but it's the little things that wear you down.
Yeah, there's different types of friction. So I'm trying to, you know, part of my research effort those two is to put formal definitions and like more structured ontology. And like I did 27 developer interviews over the summer, and I'm doing a grounded theory approach, which basically like taking what people are saying from the interviews and like coding and combining and putting together a abstract process of what the troubleshooting process looks like, the ways that people ask for help, and you know, all of these different developer flows. I'm like using the data from the interviews to construct a grounded theory about what all these various processes are, and then building a kind of conceptual model ontology to help us kind of get our mind around what these cognitive processes are that are going on during development. So if we think about programming flow, so flow is like a movement, if you will. So friction then is a force that's, you know, restricting that motion, right? If we're describing these sort of active processes that we engage in, then like friction has to be like a force relative to some kind of movement. So the way that I think about flow is flowing toward our intention. So our intention being our target vision that we're aiming toward, and then friction gets in the way of you moving toward whatever your intention is. And there
You're
can be different types of friction.
You're describing a fluid dynamics model
exactly,
here.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it kind of feels that way of more similar to like fluid dynamics. So the specific type of friction I've been focused on is confusion in particular, and for a couple of reasons. So just to define it a little more explicitly, if you write a little bit of code, and then let's say you run a test and you get some weird error message on your screen, and maybe you think you know what it is already and you just fix it and go, oh, that was it, and keep on going. But other times you try and fix and go, oh,
I don't understand.
There's something I'm missing, right? And so in that moment, when you've got some unexpected observation, you're in that state of confusion, and then you're sort of task switching, if you will, sort of gear switching anyway, from the main task that you're working on doing to trying to resolve your confusion. And so all your attention then is focused then on this process of how do I resolve my confusion in this moment? And sometimes resolving your confusion can be something that takes 10 minutes, 20 minutes. Sometimes it could take hours, days, Renee, I mean, can just go off the rails. And so what I've been developing tooling around is this process of helping developers troubleshoot and resolve their confusion by asking key questions to help them think through the problem, as well as externalizing their thoughts and trying to think more systematically about, you know.
So you're helping them rubber duck.
Yeah, I'm helping them rubber duck, right? But also as part of that process, one of the things I found in terms of just a gold mine of information is if we look at like, what are the troubleshooting scenarios that we ran into, say over the last week, that took us over 50 minutes to resolve. 50 minutes has generally been my threshold. If it's getting up there, like over 50 minutes to figure something out, usually it's a good sign that this is a conversation worthy thing that we should talk about and understand what made troubleshooting take so long. So I drive like a little retrospective process around all of the troubleshooting sessions that you know are over a threshold, and then just ask, well, what made troubleshooting take so long, and think through what was going on in that specific scenario. And one of the things you notice by using the confusion sessions as a way to identify opportunities for improvement is it highlights all of the types of difficulties that come up that aren't like things inside the code, but they have to do with the runtime characteristics of the behavior, the difficulty of being able to observe what's going on. It's all the things that have to do with like electricity going through the system, and you're observing what's going on the screen and trying to build a mental model between what you observe and what you see and what's going on in the code. And trying to connect those dots. And the reason why that's hard and the kinds of strategies and things you can do to make that easier are often things like building observability tools or, you know, like there are different kinds of things that you might do to improvement when you look at what's going on and the mechanisms we're using to resolve that confusion and troubleshooting time.
So sometimes, as an example of this, I feel like I certainly didn't do when I was a more junior developer, but now use pretty often is I encounter some piece of a system like you're talking about where I'm just confused. I have no idea. I don't understand it. And there's so much confusion that I can't even get my piece of code that I'm working on to, you know, I could churn and churn and churn and churn and get nowhere. And so what I then have to do is develop essentially some other system just so that I can understand and resolve the confusion and get to an understanding of that thing in a higher iteration way, and then take what I've learned and then be able to go back to my code that I'm actually working on and be like, okay, now that I understand this thing, now I can actually make some forward progress on that.
You have to push the stack and go off and do this other thing, and then you can come back.
Well, not so much pushing the stack. It's like I need to totally reorient around this thing into a different angle and try to get to an understanding of the system before I can go back to. So I haven't totally pushed off the task. I've just had to come at it from a different angle.
You have to come up with the right questions.
Yes.
You don't.
Yeah.
One of the things that I noticed that you did, I'm not sure if this was associated with your furry creature, but that I thought was really insightful was you said, okay, here you get stuck on something and you struggle with it for a while, and then maybe the creature suggests that you go talk to somebody else about it, but it somehow knows who else is in a flow state and it doesn't interrupt them. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
So you're thinking of it in a team situation. It's like, yeah, we want the whole team to be able to be in flow.
Yeah. So there's this other challenge that comes up of when you get stuck and you need to ask for help. So one of the things that often happens is there's some developers that will ask for help immediately or relatively soon. They maybe time limit to like 30 minutes. And if I'm still spinning on this after 30 minutes, I'll ask somebody on the team. Other developers will wait until they're about in tears and have no other options before they say anything, right? And so there's some spectrum there and reasons why, like, people don't ask for help even when they probably should, because a lot of times, like, the you get an error message on your screen, it's some esoteric thing that has nothing to do with your skill level. It's just like, but someone else on your team is like, oh yeah, you have to do X, right? And we'll know it immediately and save you hours of spinning your wheels. But often, because we have that reflex of like, I don't want people to think that I'm dumb, I don't want people to think that I didn't try, you know, whatever the reasons are of why people,
I don't want to interrupt somebody.
And that too, of like, yeah. I don't want to interrupt somebody that might be in flow themselves, because then I'm being a bother, right?
Or the problem.
But I don't want that either, right? So there's all these reasons that people don't ask for help. And now even further, now that we're in this remote environment where like we can't just see the people around us, and you can't just like look over and go, oh, well, he's clearly busy, I won't, you know, bother that guy or whatever it is, right? So now we have to make these judgment decisions without being able to see one another either. And so what the tools do is they, you know, you've got tracking in terms of like how deep people are in flow themselves across the team. And so when you're in those moments that you're stuck in troubleshooting and you've been at it for more than 30 minutes or so, and it's probably a good time to maybe consider getting some help, that based on the recent files and things that you are looking at, you can get kind of context information about where this troubleshooting area is. Then we can figure out like who's familiar or most familiar with those particular areas of code, and then who's also available right now and not in flow themselves. And so it creates a kind of like flow state aware people orchestration system for being able to coordinate help requests, where you can be able to ask for help, have someone be able to take a look at your troubleshooting notes for so far and see if they have any insights in a sort of async, more convenient way without having to worry about interrupting other people on your team.
Yeah, which seems like it would make people much more comfortable doing that, because one of the things that I notice more and more is how reluctant people are for various reasons to, I mean, it's a vulnerable thing to do, especially in our field, to admit that you don't understand something. Mm-hmm. And it wastes so much time. You know, if you're in a conversation and somebody brings something up and you go, I don't know what that is, but I don't want to, you know, stop. And I've tried to discipline myself to say, wait, I don't know what you're talking about. Please explain that. Because otherwise the rest of the conversation is pointless.
Yeah. So it turns software into a team sport. And then some of these metrics that we have around, like if managers are trying to measure individual developer productivity and how many tickets you're delivering or whatever, there's all these incentives that also keep developers from helping one another, because then they're like, oh, well, if I help you, then that takes away from my own delivery and proving my worth and all those kinds of things, right? And so so what I'm basically trying to do is create a set of visible metrics that counter some of the dysfunctional existing metrics that are driving dysfunctional behavior patterns. So one of them is rewarding people for helping out their peers. And so if you, so Furby is this little character in the tools that you level up, and you've got like a little character that's kind of like Clippy, but you know, reincarnated.
Clippy, but cuter.
Not everybody knows what Clippy is now.
That's true. Yeah. Getting old.
Yeah. But then, so you get rewarded and you level up your little Furby and get XP for helping out your teammates and things. And so there's visibility that comes with helping out, a reward that comes with, you know, helping out. And so you're focused in learning how to optimize flow as a team sport, as opposed to on an individual basis.
So the thing that you've decided through research is the metric that matters is like how much time developers are in flow state is, or you're at least saying that's representative of what we're trying to get to, the important thing that we're trying to get to. I'm curious about one piece of this, which is, have you in your research connected that back to the idea of thriving? Like, is there a connection there? Like if I'm in flow state 100% of the time, is there a correlation to that meaning that I'm also a thriving developer?
So in terms of what I'm specifically focusing on my research for my thesis, I have to keep it scoped so that I can get the project done. And generally speaking, especially me, since I've got like a bazillion things that I like, you know, directions that I'm going simultaneously, one of the challenges with putting together a formal thesis is like, I'm like, okay, I got to narrow down and pick and focus on something. And so the theory of momentum stuff is what I'm focused on for my, thesis. I've got a few different metrics around momentum in particular. So I've got time to momentum, which is from the beginning of your day, how long does it take you to get momentum going? So that's kind of your time to momentum metric. And then there's a few different metrics around momentum specifically. So flow hours is one of them, of like, how many hours am I in flow during the day? Momentum depth is another one. So that takes into account like the exponential effects of, if I have a steady period of time that I get a focus and really get deep into it, then you see kind of that exponential effect in your overall kind of throughput ability to stay in flow, versus if I had 2 hours here and 2 hours are here, I might have the same amount of flow hours, but it won't necessarily be as deep. And there's one more I have, but I can't remember it off the top of my head now.
An article that came out, I don't know, in the last few months.
Oh, the McKesson developer productivity.
Yes.
Thing.
Did you see it?
Of course. Yeah. Lots of promotion.
You had some reactions to it.
Well, and Dan North did a really nice job of taking it apart. He treated it as a draft, and he was giving comments on the draft. I thought that was very well done.
Yeah, I like that approach of like we're going to try and be kind and be courteous and be respectful in how we give a little critique back on this whole thing. But I'm not so against the existence of having some kind of metrics, but I think we need to be very, very careful about what kinds of things we make visible, because even just by creating a number for something, there's an immediate effect. Even if nobody else sees that than us, we automatically start gaming and optimizing for whatever's visible in front of us. So it's another part of the reason why I find it's important to do this work in a research context, so that we can also find out like how these different numbers and stuff actually affect people. And I try out my tools myself to see how it affects me. And then, you know, there's a certain amount of like, you know, if I do something and I'm like, I don't have a good feeling about this, you know, I don't think this is necessarily going to have the effect that I want, then, you know, I scrap things and change things too. Cause you know, my goal is to help empower developers with telling their story, with being able to explain and share like the pain and our invisible experiences, and be able to communicate these things that matter in a way with empirical data, and support developers in that. So,
and you're also trying this, your tools out on, you said, freshman students, which I think is great because they're the ones that are the most confused. So you have lots of confusion.
Well, it's a different context of, because I mean, I think it's like when you're learning to code to begin with, where is it you learn how to troubleshoot problems, or how to like stay in control of the code and like work in small micro iterations, and you know, all of these sort of like nuances of software engineering that we kind of take for granted, of stuff we just kind of do now and have that like art down. But like when you start trying to teach juniors, and one of the things that always highlights is how much tacit knowledge that you've got in your head and intuition about these things that just isn't necessarily in someone else's head. And so I think it creates a way to make some of these sort of art of software development things more visible and explicit. So you can take someone who's more junior and give them a set of practices and tools to be able to reflect on these dynamics of just staying in control of the code and not ending up confused for several hours so that you're only changing one little thing at a time. And like, learning those dynamics of things is, it creates a feedback loop for these sort of subtle invisible factors that aren't normally taught in school. So one of the things I like to figure out how to do is to use these sort of tools to augment kind of early computer science programming education to help teach these kind of things that aren't usually taught.
Nice. Yeah, it seems like there's a ton of value in teaching early programmers how to get into flow state, how to stay in flow state, how to go deeper into flow state, and giving them tools that reinforce those things and direct them.
And understanding friction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. Which is, not taught any place I've ever heard of. And it was mostly just,
we had to learn it through decades of struggle.
And even software engineering was really not that. It was just, you're actually not just going to be writing little example. You have to actually build a system. But that was, there was no real mention of the people factor, which, another book I would recommend is PeopleWare.
Okay.
Yeah, that one. Both of those, that's an easy read, and it has a lot of stuff that you're talking about.
And, awesome, thank you.
And research-based stuff. Really quite a good book, DeMarco and Lister. Hmm. Yeah.
What's the name of your fun tool? Fervy?
Tool?
Yeah, this tool you've been talking about that helps. Yeah, so
the tool is Flow Insight, which you can check out at flowinsight.com.
Nice.
And then Fervy is your little rubber ducky friend, buddy.
Is Fervy in Flow Insight? So like if you install
Flow Insight. Okay. And then, I've also got like a 3D. So I've got both 2D animation set stuff and 3D animations with Fervy. So Fervy has kind of taken on a life of its own outside of the tools as well. So,
can we get Fervy plushies for my kid?
Soon, we'll have Fervy plushies eventually. It's actually something we've talked about of just like at conferences and stuff. Like we should have some Fervy plushies too.
So you're writing you're doing all this research, but you're also writing code and building things. And then you're like dog fooding your own stuff as you're building this stuff. And then I was wondering if that's kind of the connection back to thriving, is that you probably know what thriving as a developer looks like. And so you're then taking the tools and the ways to measure flow that you're developing and almost like testing that against your mission of thriving and seeing like, are these things helping me thrive or not? Is that, I'm kind of assuming a connection there, but maybe.
Yeah. I mean, there definitely is a connection. There's some hypotheses, assumptions, just buried in that, so like, for example, like when you're deeper in flow, being in flow state has been associated with this experience of joy and this feeling of enjoyment and fulfillment and stuff. So if we, during our experiences, experience more flow, is that going
to be more joy? Yeah. I mean, for me, that's certainly true. When I get into flow state, there's the endorphins or something is flowing, and
I'm feeling
good.
This is why I'm doing this, to be in this state, and I want to be in this state as much as I can.
Yeah.
So, like, when you go home at the end of the day and feel like I had a really good day today, I really got some good work done. I feel like, and when you have that day that feels productive, right? It's usually because you were in flow, you were like in the zone, cranking stuff out, feeling like you made some good progress.
Smooth, right? Low friction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's the thing that happens to me, which is that I do something and it's like, oh, that felt really good. I want to try and get more of that feeling. and I push it too far. And then I end up coming away going, oh, now I'm, you know, I get stuck again. I don't know. It seems like there's a point where you go, okay, I'm on a high. I should stop now. And maybe put a bookmark in. That's what
one of the. No, it's things. Like when I'm deep in flow state, I'm like, oh, I'm like, I cannot just, it's not only this little problem I'm working on, I'm going to go rewrite a build tool. But to rewrite a build tool, I probably need to rewrite a programming language, and I need to rewrite a VM from scratch, and I need to then probably rewrite an operating system and rewrite BIOS. Like, I need to like do it all. It'll you know, there's awesome. Like, yeah, I'm like, I can do this. Yeah, you know, like right. when you're, you feel like a superhuman when you're in that flow state. Yeah, and then it's probably good that I haven't tried to actually do those things, because then I would like be like, yeah, I'm not the superhuman I thought I was.
Right.
Yeah. It's one of those things, like with any sort of like metric measure kind of thing, you know, you can put if you put the blinders on and that's all you focus on and you just ignore all other signals, you're probably not going to make very good decisions. But yeah. So I mean, I think there's always going to be this element of pragmaticism to things of just like, and just as, and so, you know, we, like I was saying before, of just because you're in flow also doesn't mean you're doing quality work necessarily. Like, we still need to be able to, you know, take a look at, you know, the quality of what we're producing and, you know, thinking about those things too. So I think necessary, but not sufficient, right?
Yeah, I need to surface sometimes and check the environment. You said something a little while back where you said, oh, if I try something and then I decide it doesn't feel good, I drop it. I have had experiences where I go, I don't know. I mean, a lot of it is around designing this conference. And people will come and they go, well, how about this? I go, oh, that doesn't sound right to me, but okay, let's try it. And it turns out that, oh, I'm totally wrong. And what I really needed to do was pay attention to, you know, the environment and just like, oh, no, this is what people want. I should do that, even if I have some block in my head about it.
Yeah.
You need data.
Yeah, I mean, discovery and like these unexpected things are in learning and being surprised, and you know, all of that is part of the experience too. And so looking at momentum, it just gives us one additional kind of scope of things that I think are worth thinking about that are largely invisible that we're not really taking into account right now. And I think the other thing is like momentum as like a concept, and is something that if we just even as a concept, if we think about like getting the momentum going as something that we work around optimizing for, generally speaking, I think that's probably a reasonably healthy thing to aim for, is getting our momentum going, right?
And team momentum is being a key part, I think, of
right.
that.
Yeah.
Think of the organization, not the what am I trying to get? The entity, not as the individual, but as the team together. Well, that seems like a nice summary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts? Anything we missed?
Well, do you have any final last, you know, questions or anything? We didn't really talk about any of the AR stuff. Like but that's like a whole nother thread of right. conversations. But yeah. I'm really excited about exploring sort of expanded tooling that we could use that could help us you know, better understand our environment and kind of the context we work in. We've had like the IDE for like ever now. I mean, not forever, but I mean, you know, it's like things haven't really fundamentally changed in software world really in a long time. Like, we've got IDEs and we're using text editors, and like there's been various you know, attempts on trying to do visual programming stuff, but it usually kind of goes to like this extreme. Like, I would much rather in general work with text and things I find than when I'm like, you know, with things that try and pipe little visual programming things around, I just kind of roll my eyes a little bit. This is not fun. But that said, I think there are like visualization tools that could like help us understand like the context of the system we're working in, and to be able to make these connections between like what the code is versus like what the behavior is we're seeing on the screen, and be able to make those connections of like, when I poke this thing, it makes this thing light up over here, you know, and like being able to build that mental model more effectively. I think there's a lot of potential for expanding our tool set to support some of these cognitive processes that we go through in software development to get an understanding of what's going on, especially as we get into, increasingly complex environments, throwing the AI wrench into things. And now we have all this code in the system that nobody on our team is familiar with, really, because nobody wrote it, right? Yeah. So, I mean, I think we're going to have a whole new set of ways for projects to fail in the future. And so being able to improve our tooling that helps us to develop an understanding of our code bases and sustain our understanding of our code bases, and sort of takes into account as a first order thing that what we're trying to build a mental model of is this relationship between what our code looks like and these behaviors and stuff that we see.
Yeah.
And I've been reading like papers around like developers understanding code from a research perspective. And one of the things I notice when I'm reading this stuff is a lot of these papers sort of like assume that what is the mental model in developers' head is a model of the code. Like we've got all these functions and things in our head. and when I was reading that and I started thinking, I'm like, I don't have a list of functions in my head. So you start thinking about of like, you know, because it's not something that's necessarily that clear, but it's like, what is in my brain right now when I'm thinking about, you know, these things? And that was sort of the conclusion that I came to, is it's these relationships between behavior and the code that you see that is what we have this kind of connection model between those things. And in understanding that and developing kind of these, you know, these theories around these cognitive processes and getting better clarity of what's going on, I think it opens the door to build a whole variety of new sorts of tools that can help support the cognitive support,
that help us
cognitive process of
get to that model. Because today it's, I read code, I click through a bunch of classes, I look at tests, I write code. Like I'm doing all these things to essentially map from the text and the functions to the behavior. And you're saying, hey, maybe we could actually have something that would help you get to that model more easily. Mm-hmm. And there seems like there's a lot of opportunity there.
Nice.
So that's a project you've also been working on. One of your many projects is AR. Is this something that our listeners can check out, or what's the current state?
Not yet. The talk I shared with you, I did a recent talk that's on YouTube of GDG. Southlake on visualizing friction and flow, and I demoed some of the early prototype projects that I've got with visualizing friction and flow across your code base in AR, and the context for that tooling was to support teams in doing a data-driven retrospective, so you can see like hotspots based on developer friction and how that correlates with your code. And then use that to identify, you know, where should we start our conversation about what's going on, and talking about like what made troubleshooting take so long. So those experiential perspectives, but in context of where we are in the code, when those things are happening, and then aggregated across the team. And I created like a code planetarium in AR. So kind of inspired by like a Led Zeppelin laser light show, planetarium growing up. Anyway, so I made a code planetarium in an AR context, and I demoed that a few months back.
Cool.
But I'm exploring like how can we apply AR in software engineering? So like, I'm sure you'll see some papers from me on this topic in the future.
Very exciting. Nice. Okay. Cool. Well, Artie, thank you. Yeah. Thanks for leading the charge in a lot of ways to help developers live more joyful and fulfilling lives. So that's a very cool mission. So
I like it.
Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.